This is Dr. Rebecca Danielberg, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2014 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Peggy DeVincenzo about the treatment for chronic pain. Peggy has been a clinical counselor for over 20 years and has been licensed as a professional counselor in Virginia since 1993 and as a marriage and family therapist in Virginia since 1997. She completed courses of study in the use of meditation and psychotherapy, including those with Tara Brach, Jack Kornfield, Jon Kabat-Zinn, mindfulness-based stress reduction, Ronald Siegel, and at the Barr Center for Buddhist Studies and the Institute for Mindfulness and Psychotherapy. Peggy is also a certified meditation teacher. Welcome, Peggy.
Thank you for having me, Rebecca.
All right. Well, let's dive right into the questions. The first question is, how prevalent is chronic pain in the United States, and how is chronic pain defined in medical terms?
Well, the estimates for how much chronic pain there is in the U.S. today range from 40 to 47% of the adult population.
Wow.
So that is truly huge, and that translates into 100 million to 111 million people, and this is based on the Census Bureau call center numbers. And it's defined medically as any pain that lasts 3 to 6 months or more. And, of course, it can stem from any source at all. It doesn't matter what the source is, but it's just that it lasts, it's persistent or recurrent.
That 47%, is that for older Americans or just adults?
Just adults.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes.
What are the most common types of chronic pain people experience?
Well, the most common are from headaches. They're one of the most common types, but chronic pain also results from accidents, injuries, and many different other types of illnesses, such as shingles is a very common one. I have a colleague right now who has a terrible case of shingles. CRPS, fibromyalgia, and so on. But actually what may be the most challenging of all these is something called functional pain syndrome, which is chronic pain whose origin really can't be understood or discovered. So there is definite pain there, but there simply isn't an explanation for it. So pain researchers have learned how very complicated any given pain syndrome is, but it's now understood that there's a biopsychosocial phenomenon which involves the physical stimulus, the reactions in various regions of the brain and body, the emotional reaction to the pain, and the response to the emotional reactions of those around the person suffering the pain, as they all relate back to the pain. So it's a very, very complicated picture, much more so than we really have understood in the past.
And are doctors sometimes viewing some of these patients as malingerers?
Yes, unfortunately, that is another kind of an old stigma, and particularly for women, that there is this aspect of perhaps she's using it to manipulate or have a secondary gain. So it's a very, very unfortunate thing for the person who's suffering this genuine pain. And and the other piece of this is that we also now know that, pain involves a complicated network of neurons from all different regions of the brain, from the amygdala to the prefrontal cortex to the hypothalamus and several other areas. So part of what makes the treatment of chronic pain so frustrating is that it's as the neurons kind of connect with each other in this complicated circuit, they actually create stronger and stronger networks, which then actually increases the pain. So it's almost as if the pain increases itself, and this is a well-known phenomenon. So without having this understanding, it can be easy for medical professionals to fall into you know, either thinking a person is exaggerating or it's just it's not the way that they're reporting it.
And are there some sociological factors like you should just grin and bear it, you should you know, power through, that kind of thing?
Well, I think the most common one is when someone is with a medical professional, and the response is, here are the names of psychiatrists, go consult one of these people. Because the general message is that, you know, it's about you and some problem you have, and not that it's actually happening. And so that's sort of the unfortunate sort of stigma that gets attached to this chronic pain. So it's the assumption that someone isn't actually experiencing a pain that's as severe as he or she is reporting. And so it's just, I think doctors, when they can't understand and don't know where it's coming from, they become frustrated. And so they just automatically, in order to sort of dispose of this case, many doctors will simply just make that referral and then that's it.
What misunderstandings exist about people who suffer from chronic pain?
Well, I think we've kind of just covered that in terms of this assumption that it's in someone's head, but also you know, this idea that it's a topic that's barely covered in most medical schools. So, again, unless a practitioner has experienced it him or herself, there really isn't any basis for understanding out there, for understanding this experience of someone in this kind of pain. So I think the misunderstandings that happen come from strictly a lack of knowledge and a lack of education, which is, when you think about it, rather shocking that the very professionals that you would assume would be the ones that do have this information, in fact, often don't. And of course, that's not all people. Many wonderful pain specialists and in clinics and so on. But unfortunately, this is still the minority of doctors.
And as far as misunderstandings go with chronic pain, are there misunderstandings with the family members?
There can be. And again, I view that as strictly that people don't understand. They simply don't recognize or can't imagine what it is that the person who's suffering the pain is going through. And so they want to minimize it, or they don't know what to do to help it. And so they avoid dealing with the person who's in chronic pain. And then that complicates the sense of isolation and the sense of being misunderstood, and people begin to question themselves, and that creates anxiety and depression, which we know increases pain. So,
what is the connection between chronic pain and depression or anxiety?
Well, you know, it's not much of a leap to say that people who have chronic or recurrent pain are going to experience a lot more anxiety and depression, wondering whether they'll be able to manage the pain itself, the adjustments and changes in their lives, and the effect of their pain on others, and simply the anticipation of the experience of the pain are plenty of reasons for anyone to become really anxious at some point along the way, or perhaps even chronically as they're trying to deal with it. So oftentimes anxiety becomes too much, and that's a compounding factor. And I think that's one of the things that leads a person to become discouraged and then depressed. And then we have two problems. And of course, there is a large comorbidity of chronic pain and depression, especially. And this seems to be related to negative thinking and the understandable emotional distress that's attached to the pain. So just like in depression alone, there's this sense during the moments of the most distress that one will never feel better again, or that it'll always be like this. And that thought multiplied by the pain itself can set up a declining mood in someone who suffers from chronic pain. So,
have you had much experience with anybody with chronic fatigue syndrome?
I have had a few clients with chronic fatigue, yes.
I know a counselor that's a member of ECA who talked to me about chronic fatigue, and it seems like, you know, from his thoughts were that very few medical professionals understand it.
Yes, I would say that's correct. I think it's similar to people with fibromyalgia.
So they're both kind of incessant pain, but not readily understood by medical professionals.
That's correct. And I think, again, therein lies the problem, that they're not readily understood, and the people who are supposed to be helping with this feel frustrated at their inability to help. And so, you know, maybe unconsciously they sort of try to get the problem out of their office in a well-meaning way, maybe to refer to, you know, PT or psychiatry. But it just ends up that because these syndromes aren't very well understood, and I actually think fibromyalgia is far more understood now than it used to be.
Okay.
I'm not so sure about chronic fatigue syndrome. I think that one is still not so well understood. And so these people end up really kind of being unmoored in the medical world, and it's just really not fair to them.
Yes, this gentleman whom I spoke with, who does have chronic fatigue syndrome, said that people will say things to him like, "Why don't you just drink like an espresso? Why don't you?"
Right.
and that's demeaning, isn't it?
Well, I think so, because again, it sort of assumes that the experience of the onlooker is similar or the same as the experience of the one having the pain or the chronic fatigue, and so it creates this wedge between the two people. And I think in those situations, it can be very useful for people to do their own education of the people around them who are very important to them. So their family members, doctors, therapists, very important to really help other people understand what it's like. And that's, I think, a little bit of the responsibility of the person who has the pain and the disorder. And, of course, if there are materials about it from NAMH or NIH, all the better. To help in that process.
So, yeah, doing your own research. And I'm sure sometimes as a counselor you've had to do your own research.
Yes, and certainly have done so, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So
it certainly wasn't mentioned throughout my education.
Not at all, no. And, you know, I had many years of work in the Fairfax County Mental Health Department, and where there are people who have multiple life problems, and that population has an even higher rate of chronic pain comorbid with depression or other mood disorder. So, yes, we really had to understand all these different disorders, everything from Parkinson's to rheumatoid arthritis to just all kinds of things, degenerative back disorders and so on. And if we're not doing that, then we really aren't able to help our clients.
You know, you mentioned Parkinson's, and the next question I want to ask you is someone who has both a mood disorder and chronic pain at higher risk for suicide? And in your answer, maybe you can say a little about Robin Williams, too, and his diagnosis of Parkinson's.
Well, there is a higher risk of suicide among people who have chronic pain. And a mood disorder. The numbers tell us that people living with some type of chronic pain have double the risk for suicide compared to the general population. The risk for people with recurrent headaches is even higher. So headaches of a chronic type are even worse in terms of people feeling desperate and just wanting to avoid the pain, to get out of the pain and get some relief. And that's so often, again, so many misunderstandings about what causes suicide. That's a whole nother podcast, but yes, people in the age range that Robin Williams was are at especially high risk, middle-aged to older men, white men, as a matter of fact, who have a chronic medical disorder. Now, the other thing that we know is that Robin Williams had a history of a substance use disorder, and apparently had also a mood disorder, although there were some places publicly where he denied that, but it's pretty apparent that he did, at least to me, looking at just as an onlooker. So he had so many risk factors, so many risk factors. He also had protective factors, but many risk factors, and there's no way to know what exactly it was. For most people who die by suicide, it's multiple issues. So there are things, and then there's sometimes a last straw, and perhaps for him, that was the diagnosis of Parkinson's. And I think that particularly is a difficult disorder because people who are suffering from Parkinson's, they may have many, many, many years of relatively good health, but they are looking at deterioration, at least as the disease stands now, in terms of what's available to help them.
Right, right. And so, now, I don't know if there is any correlation here, but let me just ask you, some of these diagnoses which are hard to make. So I would say Parkinson's, lupus, a lot of people with those kinds of diagnoses go through a lot of diagnoses till they get to the correct one.
Yes.
Is that a piece of all of this too?
Well, I can see where it would be.
Mm-hmm.
I have a dear friend who is a psychologist who was on literally her deathbed before they discovered that she had lupus, and she is absolutely fine now. But but I can only imagine that going through that, the pain, the disability, the deteriorating physical health would, and without any cause or any treatment that's helping, would be extremely difficult to live with, and certainly any sane person would have a suicidal thought go through their mind with that kind of distress.
Sure.
So the key would be getting help and intervening, and that's part of what we're there for.
Yeah. And getting that right diagnosis.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
Particularly lupus, chronic fatigue syndrome, Parkinson's, some of these things that are very, very difficult to diagnose. I think people have to go through a period of time where they just feel like nothing is helping me.
Yes.
You know? You know, what is the risk for addiction when someone's taking pain medication for his or her chronic pain? How can addiction be avoided, and how does addiction differ from dependence?
Well, opioid medications for pain management are highly effective for many, although not all people. They can allow people to function more normally and participate in daily life, have the ability to cope with the pain that otherwise truly can't be tolerated. So clearly they're effective in these ways, but they're also potentially addictive. The risk of addiction is greatest when someone has a history of addiction or substance use disorder. And when they're not using the medications as prescribed. So those are the two things. So if someone does have a substance abuse problem in their background, it's going to be incumbent on them to inform their medical providers of that and be sure that they're working with a pain management specialist who is well-versed in addiction. And I have known pain management specialists who are not. And so if you happen to have that in your background, it's very important that the person understand the risk for that person seeking help. So if the person's also in psychotherapy, then the therapist can be influential in helping the client monitor him or herself in the use of the pain meds. You know, the worst case scenario to me would be someone choosing not to take needed pain meds because they've had a history and be trying to cope alone and then ending up turning around and using their drug of choice and relapsing because of the pain. And I've seen this happen. So. So studies show that most people who take opioid pain medication for chronic pain don't become addicted, and that's important. Mm-hmm. It's possible, however, that in contrast to addiction, they could become dependent on the drugs. So physical dependence is different from addiction. If we use drugs for long enough and in certain doses, physical dependence is inevitable. And the biggest issue here is not that a person has an addiction, but when there is dependence and the time comes to get off the medication, there can be side effects that range from unpleasant to excruciating to downright dangerous. So the key is working with the prescribing provider and having the patients to taper down really slowly. And so, again, the treating physician needs to be skilled and experienced with this.
Does the person with chronic pain sometimes see the, you know, so they've had a lot of pain, they're taking this medication and it alleviates the pain. I could see them wanting to take it for any number of reasons, including psychological pain, you know? Does that happen? And another question I have for you is Is methadone one of the things that's being used for treatment of chronic pain?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, yes, to answer your first question, it is possible for people to then become interested in using their pain meds for other problems. And I did have a client who did this. It was someone who had been a sports star in college and and had some chronic pain as a result, and he was in his late 20s or early 30s, and so started having trouble in his marriage and did begin to use the medicine inappropriately. However, the interesting thing is it seems like when this happens, people actually come in and talk about it. Knowing that as a therapist, I'm not the one that prescribes it and can take it away. And of course, if there's a proper alliance that's been established, that yes, they will come in and talk about it. And then you have the opportunity to say, well, what do you want to do about this? Why are you telling me this? Mm-hmm. And of course, they're telling me because they know it's a problem.
Right.
Now, the issue of methadone is really tricky. Methadone is effective for pain management from what I understand. It's a very dangerous drug if it's taken in too high doses. So there are stories about people taking extra doses or ramping it up faster than what the doctor's prescribed. So so there has to be a very deep conversation about this if a doctor is going to prescribe methadone. It can be lethal.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I was reading an article as I was thinking about this interview. I was reading an article about somebody who was about a psychiatrist who is using methadone with his chronic pain clients, and I thought, wow, I had never known, and that is a serious drug. I mean, people... typically one takes methadone when they're coming down from heroin, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So it's a serious, serious drug. And I'm surprised that it's being used for chronic pain. Is it rare or is it more common?
I think it's more rare. I think this one is one that does get used with clients who have a history of addiction to opioids. So if they're using methadone, there isn't the sense of high that people get from other opioids and certainly from heroin. So there's a safety in using methadone for people who've had these types of addictions. But otherwise, no, I haven't seen it so much. The people I've worked with generally are using things like Vicodin and anything up to Dilaudid, which is pretty heavy duty, and morphine and OxyContin and those sorts of things, which are highly effective.
Yeah, and becoming really strong street drugs too,
Yes, and so falling into the wrong hands.
Now here's a big question, because both you and I are clinical counselors, and a lot of the people who are listening are too. So they are going to be interested in the answers to this question. What are the types of psychotherapeutic interventions that are effective for working with people who have co-occurring mood disorder and chronic pain?
Well, the good news is that there are a number of therapies that can be helpful for people who have chronic pain and or this major depression or other mood disorder. There's a lot of evidence for, especially for the efficacy of cognitive behavioral therapy. So it's definitely the darling of the therapeutic world right now, and it's really shows up in the world of treating chronic pain as well as mood disorder. The therapist can begin to help the client observe and understand momentary reactions to pain and to discover attitudes and underlying beliefs or assumptions about what the pain means or what others are thinking in reaction to the client's pain and so forth. So, for example, I've helped some clients develop alternative thoughts to use when they see their assumptions arising and creating anxiety or even hopelessness. So with a client who's come to over-identify with the illness, in other words, I'm nothing but my illness, a competing statement that she could use would be or could be, I have interests, desires, and goals for the healthy, able parts of myself. Or another competing comment that one could give to oneself is, I may have this illness or condition, but I still have joy, connection, and peacefulness in my life.
Mm.
So essentially what people are doing are opening the door to, wait a minute, is this all there is?
Right.
And when they open that door, then they can begin to see those things and even begin to cultivate them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way.
So
another
self-talk. It's a,
mm-hmm.
a kind
self-talk.
Of self-talk.
Yes.
Well, that sounds great. And another way.
Well, and it's really important because mm-hmm. all of these things we know from CBT need to be practiced by the client.
Sure.
So, so another important aspect of CBT involves the awareness of physical sensations mm-hmm. versus reactions to those sensations.
Mm-hmm.
So when people are using maybe some form of relaxation or mindfulness and they become mm-hmm. aware of their momentary reactions, they can learn to have more control over those reactions and recognize that there's a space between the physical sensation of pain or discomfort and how they react to that in body and in their mind and their feelings, their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So this reduces both the physical tension that exacerbates pain, and it reduces the anxious and depressive thinking that can create that negative feedback loop. So by
sure.
working to help the client modify these reactions when they have a sensation of pain with relaxation techniques, mindfulness practices, et cetera, that strong association of the sensation of pain with a reactive mind can be broken and then eventually replaced with a more useful response, such as recognizing that perhaps rest, exercise, or a dose of pain medicine is needed.
Mm-hmm.
And in some situations, chronic pain, so here's another form of therapy, chronic pain may have a strong link to childhood trauma. So in that case, it's important to understand that connection first and really give some strong validation and understanding to the client, help
can
them
you,
make sense of it.
Can you give an example of that?
Yes. The example is a client who had a degenerative bone disease as
mm-hmm.
a child. The disease caused him to be hospitalized multiple times at a very young age, involving a lot of time away from his parents.
Mm-hmm.
So anxiety and fear became closely associated with abandonment for him,
mm-hmm.
and simply and the pain got all wrapped up in that. And simply having an understanding of that, as well as strengthening his sense of connection in present day to current mm-hmm. family and friends, and then developing other coping strategies, really helped him reduce his fear and panic when he would have to have necessary surgeries as an adult.
Hmm.
So mm-hmm. we had to have the larger understanding. So there's the psychodynamic and family systems
yes.
Therapy that comes in
uh-huh.
Before you go to treating and trying to help work directly with the pain and the reaction to the pain.
Mm-hmm.
So above all, yeah, very interesting case,
very interesting.
I thought. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the most important part, though, of effective therapy with a person mm-hmm. with chronic pain is to use a collaborative model, and I think we'll be talking about that in a few minutes.
Okay. Okay. What about exercise? Is it effective in ameliorating chronic pain?
You know, the research says that exercise at manageable level for the person suffering the pain is absolutely critical to the management
mm.
of the pain. There's
mm.
virtually no evidence to suggest that exercise, if it's done at an appropriate level,
mm-hmm.
is harmful, and that is incredibly good news because we know that exercise serves so many purposes, from releasing endorphins to giving a
mm-hmm.
sense of well-being to providing some sense of control over the body. And just plain maintaining levels of bodily ability itself. So the evidence also indicates that virtually every type of chronic pain is improved
mm-hmm.
with exercise.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
So it's particularly the case for people who suffer from fibromyalgia.
Mm-hmm.
There are really big numbers that show up when we test people or the researchers test people before and after exercise programs. So, and we know that fibromyalgia is incredibly painful.
Right.
So studies from this country and some overseas point mm-hmm. to the significant decrease of pain and disability for those with fibromyalgia. myalgia mm-hmm. when they engage in either low or moderate intensity exercise. So the belief behind this, the theory is that there's a decrease in inflammation that occurs.
Aha. Uh-huh. And does diet help with that too, the decrease in inflammation?
You know, I know that is generally known. I haven't mm-hmm. seen the data as mm-hmm. it relates to mm-hmm. the inflammation of that occurs with any type of chronic pain. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure about the direct connection, but my understanding is, yes, that there are dietary changes that mm-hmm. that can reduce inflammation in the body in general. And so, gosh, you know, mm-hmm. it can't hurt.
Yeah, and I think Andrew Weil, who's in Arizona, is mm-hmm. a Harvard physician, he talks about that as well. He has a couple of books, so people could, you know, go and look for that, decreasing inflammation through diet to treat chronic pain. Okay, and so go ahead.
I was just going to say there's another condition mm-hmm. that I just wanted to mention. Lower back pain is significantly improved by exercise.
Yeah.
There's a syndrome that can occur in particular with patients in, mm-hmm. in which certain movements with back pain tend to be avoided because of the fear of pain or damage to the back. And there's a name for this phenomenon. It's called kinesiophobia, which is a great word for us in the,
yeah.
in the psychotherapy profession, kinesiophobia. And this then creates its own problem by reducing flexibility, range of motion, mm-hmm. and ultimately decreasing mobility and increasing stiffness and pain. So there are more than one programs out there that specifically address this particular phenomenon very successfully with low back pain and other similar musculoskeletal kinds of pain. And they involve gradually exercising to loosen and strengthen muscles in the back, kind of unwinding that whole dynamic of unintentional protection and the increase in pain to a point where it gets kind of unwound and goes the other direction so that the pain mm-hmm. is decreased. And one of these programs in particular is Ron Siegel's BackSense program, and there's a book out that he's written called BackSense.
And if there's any links you want to give us for those who are listening to this podcast, we can put them at the end of this podcast when it's in print on our site.
Okay, great. I'll do that.
Yeah. What about the phenomenon of I want to exercise, but I'm in too much pain to exercise? I want to exercise. I know I should exercise, but every time I lift that, you know, leg, it hurts me. How does one work with that?
You know, it's so important to really get in there and work with those mm-hmm. fears and those thoughts, because with chronic pain, it's all about what type of exercise, what degree of exercise. So if it hurts too much to lift a leg, then work with your arms.
Mm-hmm.
Do some exercise with the arms. You know, I even saw a mechanism that would be wonderful for people who have some level of disability, and it's a kind of like a stationary bicycle for your arms,
mm-hmm.
and you can set it on a table and use it directly in front of you, so you're getting aerobic exercise, but with your arms. You're also building mm-hmm. muscle strength in your arms without having to use your legs if your legs are sore.
Mm-hmm.
If you have pain all over your body, it might be that you would go to a gentle yoga class or do a slow, easy walk around mm-hmm. your neighborhood. It's mm-hmm. all about scale,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
scaling the exercise to what you're able to do. And I'm sure there are resources out there. I would think that a physical therapist or occupational therapist would be wonderful resources for managing this particular mm-hmm. situation.
And as the baby boomers come into the age range of arthritis, of osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis is even worse,
yeah.
but osteoarthritis, what are you thinking about all that?
Well, I'm thinking a lot about it, Rebecca, because
yeah.
I'm well into that age.
I am too. And,
So we're...
And many listening will be as well.
Exactly.
So
we're all
right
feeling
yeah.
our aches and pains. And mm-hmm. and so, again, movement is really critical, and starting out at a certain level and then ramping up as you're mm-hmm. able, but not too fast. I'm a huge believer in yoga, and the reason I love mm-hmm. yoga is because in its purest form, the way it is practiced is that you do it within your own physical capability.
Mm-hmm. You can and do so, chair yoga, right? You
exactly. Can. There's yeah. chair yoga. There's gentle yoga, mm-hmm. and so that's one way of easing into. But the thing about yoga is that you're stretching. You're stretching and moving. Mm-hmm. just about every single muscle in your body. Mm-hmm. And I know from my own experience, when I practice yoga, I feel 10 years younger.
Oh, yeah.
So that, and then if you can add into that some cardio aerobic mm-hmm. exercise, mm-hmm. then you really have a dynamite combination. And, of course, weight training is important for a muscle tone, and that's important yeah. for both men and women, but especially important for women because they're at mm-hmm. higher risk of osteoporosis.
What about swimming?
Well, swimming is ideal, particularly mm-hmm. with the condition of a particular pain or overall pain, because mm-hmm. you're really being held up by the water.
Yeah.
So the resistance is there, but there's this buoyancy, and so it tends not to be as hard on your body and much easier to exercise if you're modest about it.
I know when I was pregnant many years ago, I remember being at the very end and being very uncomfortable all over my body. I just was so uncomfortable at the very end. And the only thing that made me feel better was to swim, because when I got in that water, it was like I had no weight.
Yes.
It was wonderful. So,
if people don't know how to swim, it's a wonderful mm-hmm. time to learn it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, now here's something you know a lot about, and I'm looking forward to learning from you. How does meditation help with chronic pain?
Well, there are several forms of meditation, and I think all of them can be instrumental in reducing pain and certainly the emotional distress that results from it. One of the most common forms, and the form that I'm trained most heavily in, is called mindfulness meditation, mm-hmm. in which one focuses on the present moment in a very deliberate, specified way for a period of time. And the idea with this is not so much, like people think, to empty the mind as it is to observe what is happening in the mind and in the body. Mm-hmm. So in this way, for example, a person with rheumatoid arthritis, here's an example, might be paying attention to pain in the hands as they're practicing meditation. And then they may notice that they have a fearful thought about the progression of the disease. Mm-hmm. That might lead to a negative fear, a disturbing fear that perhaps this person won't be able to hold her granddaughter anymore. Mm. So the realization that that thought came out of a physical sensation is a moment of recognition for the patient, that she's carrying perhaps an exaggerated fear of disability, or that a certain thought or a certain sensation in the body becomes somehow 3 years or 10 years down the road, you know, a problem, you know, that's going to have far-reaching consequences when there is absolutely no indication that that is necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
So with meditation, we're learning to kind of understand those connections and, in a sense, not give so much weight to them, not give so much attention to them, just recognize that they are simply thoughts coming and going, just like when we watch a train go by. There are cars on the railroad train. We don't necessarily jump onto one of those cars. We mm-hmm. just watch them as they go by.
Mm-hmm.
So in doing so and learning to watch these thoughts come and go without getting caught up, we're also avoiding the creation of distortion. And when we have distortion of thought, then we have a particular attitude that gets formed, and attitudes have a huge influence on mood.
Hmm. Wow. Okay, so a client comes in, and you say, let's talk about meditation as something that you can do to help with your chronic pain. And they say, oh, I'm not into all that. I don't understand any of that.
Mm-hmm.
How might you work with them?
I would tend to integrate some parts of meditation into the work with the client. So the client may be sitting across from me with their eyes open, and I might say, what are you feeling in your body right now?
Mm-hmm.
And they might be able to describe that. Some people are very good at this the very first mm-hmm. time they try it. And what's happening in your body? Okay, are you noticing something else now, or are you still feeling the first thing?
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on in your mind now? Is there a thought in your mind?
Mm-hmm.
So we're really sort of walking someone through a little bit of guided meditation in a very general sense. And once a person becomes familiar and comfortable with just the simple paying attention, because really that's all meditation is, it's paying attention, and they become comfortable with that, then they're often very open to utilizing it in a more formal way. So then I might introduce something like relaxation, a body scan, progressive muscle relaxation, things that can, again, help the person recognize what's going on in the body and almost become desensitized to it. So there's a desensitization that can go on that, that really reduces fear and distress. When there's a calm feeling that gets associated with the experience of physical sensations, then people are able to break that kind of fight or flight reflex that comes zooming in when we feel pain. And that's a part of the magic of meditation or mindfulness or relaxation.
And when you said guided imagery meditation, I've done that with clients over the years, and they've had some of the most profound insights during that time.
Indeed. It can be so powerful. And the other thing it can be...
What are they getting in touch with when they have those profound...
Well, here's what's happening. In guided imagery and also in any kind of relaxation, people are accessing the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the part of the nervous system that has to do with all the things that go on as a matter of course when we're not in crisis. Our bodies are fine. We're going about our day. And so they amplify, these kinds of meditations will amplify that feeling and help a person recognize that feeling, practice it. And in the guided imagery, that happens because a person is perhaps creating a scene that's very pleasant to them. They're recalling something positive about the beach or the mountains or sitting by a river. And so those positive experiences, feelings, and places in the brain, as a matter of fact, are all occurring at the same time. So now we're exercising the resilient parts of ourselves just simply by sitting. And we're calling online those positive and healing aspects of the parasympathetic nervous system that are not online when we're going and we're in crisis and we're our sympathetic nervous system is activated.
Right. And when we go, we tighten our muscles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing that people can recognize is that tightening occurs, pain increases. So all of these other ways of meditation can serve a very strong purpose in counterbalancing pain.
Very interesting. How would people learn, let's say somebody wants to learn to meditate on their own, how would they do that?
This is something that has become easier and easier. There are literally probably thousands of podcasts, downloadable hour-long meditation, guided meditation sessions and so on that are available on the internet. And there are also, depending upon where you live, there are places to go, meditation centers where you can learn how to practice. And they're all a little bit different, but with a little bit of research, you can kind of find out which one is for you. Zen meditation tends to be slightly more focused on concentration practices. And Vipassana or insight meditation, which is mindfulness meditation is focused more on what's happening right now. What's happening? Simply that question and being with it, and as well as adding in other practices, which I think are critical to people with, especially with co-occurring mood disorder and chronic pain, such as loving kindness meditation and self-compassion meditations. So looking for relaxation types of meditations, loving kindness and self-compassion meditations, I think would be a good place to start online. And then looking perhaps for a meditation center or a yoga studio where oftentimes there will be a meditation class.
Yes, I like the self-compassion meditation. I think that people with chronic pain need to have self-compassion because sometimes they will be dealing with a doctor or a family member who might not completely believe them and what they're going through. And to have self-compassion at that time would seem very important.
I totally agree. I think that's probably the most important time to be practicing self-compassion.
Are there other alternative or complementary approaches to treating chronic pain that are effective?
There are quite a few. Mm-hmm. Everything from,
acupuncture.
Acupuncture is one of the big ones, and that is proven to be effective with certain types of pain. Mm-hmm. Some pain, I have a client right now who has nerve pain, and it hasn't helped at all. In fact, it was probably making her pain worse, so she stopped trying that.
Mm-hmm.
Acupuncture is one, and it's a good one to start with. We mentioned yoga before. There are various types of energy therapy that some people have been helped by, but to date there isn't a lot of evidence that they are effective. But in my experience, there isn't a whole lot of necessarily connection between what has been proven to be effective and what actually is effective.
Yeah,
so I think you have to try things that maybe are appealing to. Electromagnetic stimulation of various kinds is another type of alternative treatment, and some of them do have limited success.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many more for the patient and the medical provider to explore.
Mm-hmm.
The exact effect on any given patient is really, really individual, and sometimes, like I said, is kind of irrelevant of the data available on that particular type. One more word, though, about meditation and the mind-body connection.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's important, and I always mention it somewhere in my therapy with people with chronic pain, is to have them gain an understanding, an education about the neuroscience involved in both mood and pain and how the brain is wired. And that's, fortunately, we have lots of resources right now.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorites right now is Rick Hansen, has a couple of books. Sharon Begley also wrote a wonderful book. And so we can perhaps add these on
to the link.
As links.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I think it's important for clients to themselves understand that beyond me sort of explaining it to them.
Mm-hmm.
It really allows them to get a tremendous amount of validation about what's going on. It makes it very clear in their own minds that, yes, this is really happening.
What about EMDR or tapping? Are either of those used for chronic pain?
You know, I have not run across that in my research on this, nor have I used those myself.
Okay.
That may be the case, but I don't know that there's a lot of evidence about that.
Right.
My understanding with EMDR is there's lots of evidence that it works for other, strictly, psychiatric, psychological problems. But it would
trauma.
Be very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, trauma. Mm-hmm. To learn whether perhaps it could help with chronic pain.
It would be interesting. Okay, this is our last question, and boy, has this been interesting and insightful. The last question is, ACA currently has 55,000-plus members, most of whom are clinicians. Is there anything I have not asked you that you want our members to know?
The thing that I think is most important is kind of creating an approach when someone walks in your door with a condition of chronic pain. And that's to create a collaborative team approach, and it means encouraging the client to have the best medical professionals and social supports available to them, everything from pain specialists to physical therapists, good friends, family support groups, all the things we know about. This will provide multiple types of resources to be available all along the way and to allow the client to have people to call on, to have their go-to people, and reduce that sense of isolation and sense of being different from others. The next step in this process is assessing and monitoring the basics with your client. It's so important not to assume that because someone has a physical illness or they look put together that they're eating well or sleeping well or have a reasonable routine. It's so critical, and I do this with every one of my clients, regardless of chronic pain. So looking at sleep, nutrition, exercise, routine, daily goal setting. The latter, the daily goal setting, is particularly important in the case of the greater physical disability and pain, because it's very easy for someone who feels defeated by pain not to get out of bed or out of the house if there isn't a reason. So
sure.
Just small, achievable goals every day based on what's reasonable and possible for that person.
Mm-hmm.
The next step would be building in flexibility and prioritizing. So if a client is having a rough pain day but had planned to do some housework, can she shift that goal to later in the week and create another goal for today, such as making phone calls? Another step, build in relaxation and fun as a part of on an ongoing basis, so including anything from frequent breathing breaks to watching funny movies, getting together with a friend. So a breathing break is simply taking 2 minutes one or more times every day to stop and focus on the breath with two deep breaths followed by the return to regular breathing and then mindful breathing. Encouraging clients to learn some form of relaxation, guided imagery, self-compassion is really, really important. And then next would be helping the client to live life at a pace that's appropriate for him or her given the illness. So, for example, a client of mine knows never to schedule more than one appointment of any kind in one day. When she does schedule more, she loses a couple of days afterwards because she's so fatigued. Encouraging clients to stay at the very top of their particular physical ability level. Again, all the data supports this. So through one or more types of exercise, another client I work with takes long walks with her dog, but also engages in just a gentle yoga class once weekly. So doing at the very top of what your capability level is. And then finally, suggesting to clients that they maintain a mood and a pain diary. So as humans, we tend to gravitate toward what's wrong. What's unpleasant? You know, we hear that saying, we are Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. So that's what we do. It's just
that's
human
right.
nature.
Yeah.
So we tend to gravitate towards what's wrong. So we unintentionally screen out from our memory the times when we're feeling better. When someone has a mood log and can look at her levels and variation across time, it becomes apparent that there are good days as well as the more difficult ones. So this can provide hope that tomorrow, next week, sometime in the future is going to be a better moment than this one.
I love that. That's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you so much, Peggy DiVincenzo, for discussing the treatment of chronic pain with us. I want to thank you for giving us any links you give us that so that our members can learn more about chronic pain. I also want to thank Naisha Smith for helping me research the topic of chronic pain. To view links to this program, to write to the presenter or the host, please go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2014 podcast series, signing off.